Welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage as we travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, a panel discussion on the power of educating girls. The discussion followed a screening of Girl Rising, a film about the power of education to transform societies told through the stories of nine different girls around the world. The film screening and panel discussion was hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council in partnership with Alaska Public Media and recorded on December 5th. Executive Director of the Alaska World Affairs Council, Lisa Falsko, served as moderator.
So first, I will introduce our panel, do a really quick, brief introduction. You can see what diverse backgrounds these individuals have and their perspective. I'll ask a couple general questions from each of them and then open it up for questions from the audience. Again, if you could write them on the piece of paper and just pass them down to your left, we'll collect them and bring them up and ask the questions for our radio listeners. To my immediate left, we have Kimberly Pace. She grew up in thriving metropolis of Soldotna, Alaska.
Pretty exciting.
She did her undergraduate work at the University of Montana and graduate work at Miami University in Ohio and has been teaching at UAA since 1998. She is the faculty director of Model United Nations of Alaska, the director of women's studies at UAA, and she teaches classes both face-to-face and online. And we're thrilled to have her here face-to-face today to be part of our panel. And to her immediate left, we have Brian Callahan, and he is the Advocacy and Outreach Manager for Global Campaign for Education U.S. Chapter, who made this possible and has a brochure outside. It's a coalition of more than 50 national and community-based organizations working to ensure access to quality education for all children around the world. Brian's advocacy experience also includes working with the Child Labor Coalition to eradicate child labor in the Uzbekistan cotton sector and the cocoa fields of West Africa. And to his left, we have Zeynep Kilic. Zeynep grew up in Turkey and studied economics at the Middle East Technical University of Ankara. She arrived in the U.S. in her early 20s, so just a couple years ago, and completed her master's and PhD in sociology in Arizona State University. She's currently an assistant professor at UAA in the sociology department. And to her left, Shayla Anjum is an editor and writer in Anchorage. She's originally from Karachi, Pakistan. She has lived in the US since 1968 and Alaska since 1977. She received her undergraduate degree at the University of Minnesota, a master's in public administration from the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, and most recently a master's of fine arts from the University of Alaska, Anchorage. Welcome everybody here today.
Thank you so much.
So with such a diverse group, you heard a little bit of their background. I'd like to start out with, how did this story resonate with you personally? And we'll start. We're gonna start down the line.
Okay. Well, I want to say thank you. Thank you, Lisa and the World Affairs Council, for inviting me to be in part of this panel. And my fellow panelists, I'm in awe of your accomplishments. And thank you to the audience who came out on such a brisk evening. And I'm just delighted to see former students, future students, and my colleagues from the Political Science Department. Thank you for coming. I am, just today, all day long, I have been drawn to my computer screen watching the news about the death of Nelson Mandela. Every once in a while, perhaps in a generation, maybe two, we are gifted with immense statesmen. And I really truly believe that Nelson Mandela was that for my generation and many others. So as I knew I was preparing to come tonight, and I knew this was going to be one of the first questions that we would be asked, I did some research on Nelson Mandela and his thoughts on education. And so I'm going to share with you a quote that many of you may have heard before, but it is from Nelson Mandela, and he said, "Education is the most powerful weapon which you can use to change the world." And I saw that and I thought, this is what I want to bring to this discussion, because it is my belief that this is true, particularly for young girls. And we saw in this film such beautiful stories of these young girls and their struggles and hope. And I think that that, for me, is what resonated with every story, was the hope that they had and the perseverance and what it is that they went through, their challenges to achieve what they have already done. And as Nelson Mandela says, education is the most powerful weapon which you can use to change the world. And I know that each of those girls are going to change the world and all of the lives that they will touch, and so many others as well. So thank you.
Thank you. Brian.
Sure. Well, let me just again say thank you to Lisa and the Alaska World Affairs Council for helping us bring this film to Anchorage, and to the Alaska Public Media for hosting us, and all of you for coming out here. I think this is maybe now the 10th or 15th time I've seen this movie, but every time I see it, there's new things I pick up. So I'm just trying to think of what are some of the new things I noticed in watching this. And I was really struck, and I never noticed this before, by the power of one person in this film. And in all of these stories, there was one person who could really make a change in their own lives and make a change in other people's lives, whether it was Wadley, you know, with her persistence in getting an education in post-conflict, post-earthquake Haiti, or Suma in Nepal, and the power of a traveler who came into her home. You know, he changed her life, and she sort of used that education that she was able to get from him to change lives in Nepal and to try to eradicate this practice of Kumlari in Nepal. I was also struck by just the magnitude of barriers that exist for girls to get an education. I think this film actually really touches on that well, but thinking about child marriage is an issue in getting an education, thinking about tremendous economic barriers, thinking about geographic barriers, and I like the chapter on India because, you know, it's not always about a man not wanting his daughter or his sister to get an education. Sometimes they're actually big supporters of them getting an education, and that chapter specifically looked at, you know, they were from a village where there really wasn't access to education, and her father actually made these huge sacrifices to come into the city to get an education. I every time I watch it, I'm struck by how much the girls in this film want to go to school. I think that's something, you know, when I travel to talk to school groups in the U.S., sometimes we take for granted the access to education that we have. And none of these girls, you know, were dragged into the classroom. They all, you know, saw the power that education held for them. And also, just every time I watch this movie, you know, I'm always thinking about the fact that this is 9 stories, some of which end on a positive note and some of which don't. But that's 9 stories out of, you know, 57 million children that don't have access to primary school and 100 million don't have access to primary or secondary school. So it's just, you know, as much as this film moves us, it's sort of, I don't know, alarming or depressing to think about the fact that these are just 9 stories out of millions of girls who probably have, you know, similarly positive and negative experiences in education. So I don't want us to be depressed about it, because I think the film shows the power of educating a girl and the power of empowering a girl through education. But, you know, we have a lot of work to do to make sure that all girls around the world get that same access.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brian, and thanks, Lisa. Well, actually, I was really resistant being on this panel, because I thought, gender is not my expertise. Like, what am I supposed to say? I grew up rather privileged. Like, I don't have anything to say about this. But I actually had so many things that resonated just within few generations of my family and the women's history in my family that, you know, I kind of have to edit myself now. But very quickly, you know, my grandmother was a child bride, my maternal grandmother, and she was kind of engaged at 8, promised at 8, and then was kidnapped by another family around, I think, 12, when she was 12. And but the customs in Turkey is such that you wait till, you know, the girl becomes a young woman. So she was, I guess, sleeping with the sister-in-law till she became available. And then so at 14, she was pregnant. You know, she had her first kid at 15. Then we go to next story to my mother's generation. And both her and my other two aunts, they just have about an equivalent of, I would say, middle school education. And, you know, here I am. I have a PhD. I went to college. But of course, by the time it came around to my generation, I was living in a big city, in the capital city. It's lower middle class to middle class. So the expectation was that you get education. It doesn't matter if you're a girl or a boy. My father was in the army, and that's sort of a lucky situation because army is staunchly secular, and that meant that that was also part of the, you know, girls are going to be educated just as much as the boys. So I'm the middle child, but I've always had my brothers also support everything I do. Like at this point in time, my younger brother is actually transcribing some interviews for me to make it possible for me to actually finish my research. So, you know, I just have to kind of think that obviously I'm so privileged compared to all of these stories, but I am also close enough to some of these stories to kind of know and understand how privileged and lucky I am. I think a big part of it is luck. And then another big part of it is really the men in your life can make a huge difference in terms of, they can change the course of your life. The fact that, you know, my grandfather, even though he didn't necessarily educate my mother, he did give them the option of going further. The first gift that he gave us was a dictionary, because he said, people who don't have words are like people who don't have change in their pockets. You know, without money, you can't do much. You'll feel, you know, suffocated, and without words, you'll feel the same. So always make sure to have change in your pocket and lots of words in your vocabulary. So, and my father was, you know, like the story in India really resonated with me because, so I grew up, I mean, relatively privileged, obviously, but I knew the stories. I knew that my father, you know, grew up with seven additional siblings, and father died when he was two, and you know, he was like a goat shepherd, and he had to walk 15 miles barefoot to go to get education, and he would have to just eat the dry bread for 2 weeks before he can come home. And he told us those stories, so you know, I knew that it was a responsibility. It wasn't a burden, but it was a responsibility that you had to move forward. But I always wanted to learn music, but I thought, you know, no, you need math, you need science, so therefore I'm never gonna ask for that because we can't afford it. But my aunt apparently told my father that I really wanted to learn an instrument and shouldn't I make the effort. And the first time that he retired from the army, when he got a little bit of money, first thing he did was to buy me a guitar. I mean, it was a very cheap, really terrible guitar, but regardless, those are the kinds of stories that kind of tell me, you know, it makes a huge difference. Men in your life can really make an amazing sort of, I guess, opportunities and possibilities even bigger. When I wanted to come to the U.S., the first thing my mom said, what are you going to do as a girl? You know, not that she didn't believe I can do it, but she said, oh, it's just too hard, you know, by yourself, don't do it. But my father said, if you think you have the ovaries to do it, you know, go for it, so to speak. So in that sense, you know, I kind of feel like, you know, I have so many stories that kind of resonate. I'm removed enough from it, luckily. So I guess I can think that I'm so lucky that I didn't have to experience those things. But I also have a few cousins in the village in the Black Sea Mountains. Exact same story. Their brothers are in college and girls stay back because somebody needs to take care of the cows, you know? So when you go during the summer, it's nicer when there are people taking care of the cows and the food, the whole thing. So in that sense, we've come a long way, but honestly, it's not that far back. So it kind of made me think of all those things.
Fascinating. Thanks. Shayla.
with me, the story that also resonated with me was the same one as Zainab, the father in Calcutta, but in a very different kind of way, because unlike that father, my father, who was quite educated, and I come from a family of very educated people, and most of my maternal side of my family, the women were going to school and boarding schools and colleges way back in the days when the British ruled India in the 1920s and 30s. And my father, who was a naval officer, very erudite, extremely well-educated, taught the cadets at the Naval Academy in Pakistan. I grew up on the base when I was young. And he taught me to read Shakespeare, made me memorize poetry by Wordsworth and Coleridge and Shelley and all these people. But at the same time, he was a drunk, so he decided that my older sisters could not go to school beyond high school. And that became a big problem in our house. So we separated from him. And I went on to go to school and came here. And what I liked about that story, the one about Rukhsana, was how the father was so supportive. And I find it really, really ironic that I come from a country where the illiteracy rate right now stands at about 80%. 80% of the people in Pakistan cannot read and write. And for women, it's even higher. And Pakistan ranks about 180th in the world among 221 countries in that low rate of literacy. And I'm privileged to have had the chance to know Malala Yousafzai and her father. And for me, that father is the great example of how all fathers should be in Pakistan. He told me once that I should not ask him what is it that he did for his daughter, but that I should ask him what he did not do to his daughter, that he did not clip her wings so she could fly. And I find that such an interesting point of view. But what has happened in this whole aftermath of Malala Yousafzai's shooting and her ascendancy to fame is that more and more people are looking at putting their kids in school in Pakistan. And enrollment has actually jumped quite a bit in the last year in the province where she comes from. And overall in Pakistan, there's a sense of empowerment in the children, in the girls particularly, because of her, even though there are people in Pakistan who consider her Western agent and are railing against her, but at the same time, her story has really hit home the problem of why we need children to be educated, especially girls. People now realize that you cannot have, not have girls go to school, because if you have an educated person who is a woman, when she gets married, she'll be able to figure out for herself whether or not her children should get polio vaccine or not. Just simple things like that.
Fascinating, fascinating. So as you're writing down your questions, pass around your papers, I've got one more. And that is with our diverse panel here, we can go down the line again, and maybe you can share your number one takeaway that you got from this movie.
I'm assuming the same order. Wow, there are so many. Well, it goes without saying, educate girls, that makes sense, right? That we get this. But I think, as I am, one of the hats that I wear is political scientist. And as a political scientist, I'm looking at these, as a women's studies director and political scientist, I merge those two hats together and I look at that and I'm seeing possibility. And when I look at those stories, I see young girls who are going to become empowered and they are going to make changes in their communities, in their cities, and in a political way. And that might include an office or running for office, or it might include voting. It might include talking to someone about the importance of being engaged an engaged citizen. And I think that's my number one takeaway from this, is that I see possibilities for political action at all levels. So I think that's my number one takeaway.
Well, I totally agree with you. And I think I would just add that I think there's that opportunity not just on the part of these girls, but on the part of us. I really think, you know, as I said earlier, I'm always struck by the power of one person. And you know, Malala is such an amazing example of the power of one person and having that determination. And she was not going to give up until she got an education. And not just her, but all of the girls in Pakistan got an access to education. I think we all really need to be doing more to help ensure that these girls get access to education. And, you know, we'd love to have you join our campaign at gce-us.org. You can pick up a brochure if you're in the room. And we have an action sheet as well that you got in the room and is on the website if you want to take some action. We also are, as Lisa mentioned, a partnership of about 60 different organizations. So if you work with an organization that's doing anything internationally with girls, with boys on education, please find me after and I'd love to chat with you. And, you know, there's lots of opportunities to do this work. I think that goes beyond, I mean, the film, you know, the film has a request for money at the end, but I think that we could be doing a lot more than just giving money. I think it's about talking about these issues. It's really, you know, exciting for me to see, you know, 100 people come out here on a icy night to talk about an issue that sometimes people don't really think affects us, but I would say it does affect us. We have a responsibility, but also, you know, the film, I don't need to recite statistics. The film goes through quite a lot of statistics about how educating girls, you know, changes economies and changes countries. But I think it does, you know, it does affect us here as well. I think I'll stop there and wait for more questions.
I guess I was thinking along the same lines in the sense that, you know, what do you do with this kind of information? You know, you can donate money, which is great. It makes you feel good too. You know, you did your good deed kind of thing. But I think I guess if you can be a muse, if you can get people to sort of get to a point of being able to dream about something different, like the possibility of something different, is much more powerful. So again, going back to my personal stuff, my youngest aunt got married at 16 because she was too beautiful. So they were concerned that she was going to be kidnapped, was getting too much attention. So just like, you know, the other stories we've heard, it was better for her off to be just married off. But she got an educated husband, you know, college educated and engineer. And her son is about maybe 10 months younger than me, and we're pretty close. So I remember visiting her when I was about maybe my second year of high school, maybe first or second year, I can't quite remember. But I remember she was saying that she was jealous that when we were studying, because, you know, we had to take the college exams, and it's like the most serious exam you will ever take. There are like 2 million students taking it, 600,000 can get into it, only maybe 10% gets into the good schools. So your entire life, you're constantly preparing for this exam. And she said she was bored, that most of the women that she had to hang out with during the day, that she was bored. And I said, well, why don't you just study with us and, you know, take the exam? And she said, well, I'm not a high school graduate. Well, I said, then you have 2 years before we take the exam. Go get the high school education. She said, oh, you know, I have all these responsibilities. I don't know, at this age, it's not appropriate. People would find it weird because we don't really have returning students in Turkey. So everybody is like an appropriate age when they go to school. But when I left, she said that the following week, I guess they had an argument with her husband, and the husband just cut her off and just said, what do you know anyway? You barely graduated from middle school, so just shut up. And she got so pissed off, so the next day she finds the school, and she was quite artistic, actually, and she painted even as a very young girl, and my grandfather encouraged it. So she found a school where you can kind of do half of it at home and then go take some classes. And actually she finished and she studied with us and went through the exams with us. And she kept wanting to go to law school because everybody said, oh, you have like such, you know, fiery personality, you'll make a great lawyer. But she just couldn't get to like the math and all that part. And I just said, why? I mean, you're so good at painting, just go for arts. So when she was visiting us, she went and took the exam, the talent exam. She got in. So she finished college with us. Then she went on to get her master's. Then she wanted to do her PhD, but you have to pass the English exam. And she couldn't for like 7 times. And she kept saying, I think I'm too old to learn this. I said, no, you can do it. And she actually came and visited me. We studied some together, and she passed. And now she's in her second or third year. She's working full time and editing a children's magazine. And she's so fiery right now. She feels like she's saying, I'm going to write a book. She published 2 poetry books. She learned to play an instrument. She's actually composing. And that, to me, is so much more impressive, right? I mean, like the fact that she can just think, oh, it's not really for me, to the next point of saying, well, maybe, wait a minute, you know, other people are doing it, maybe I can do it with them. So I think being able to, you know, show people that there are possibilities is important. But then I come to my life in the US, and I'm married to an American man who comes from an extremely poor background. I mean, he barely finished high school, barely can spell, but has made an amazingly successful life for himself. And he's been like literally working since age 6 to feed himself, kind of a poor. And now his kids are so privileged, yet so unaware of his story. And, you know, they can go to school at UAA through me, free, and they just say they don't have the time, and what's that gonna do anyways? And they're not interested, and they just think it's a bunch of rich kids go to school anyways. And if they, you know, do something really, you know, either disrespectful or just, you know, like break stuff in our house, etc., they'll usually say something like, who cares? You can afford it, like buy another one. And that kind of stuff, just, I can't get over it. I'm like, how is it possible that their father just, you know, 30 years ago was like literally working 15 hours a day just to be able to feed himself, and they can't make the connection that that's an incredible like trajectory that they are, and that their, you know, their uncle is in somewhere in Seattle in jail, their kids are thrown to the winds, and like how lucky you are, right? I mean, like you can do so much, and they don't want to do it. And when I asked them and I pushed them, I said, how is this possible? Why don't they feel more gratitude? And he said, well, I didn't want to burden them. You know, I wanted them to have an easier life than I had, and I didn't want to constantly tell them the stories. And I just thought, that's a loss. You know, my father's story or my mother's story or my grandmother's story, to me, it just gives me impetus. It gives me gratitude. It makes me feel how lucky I am. You know, it's not because I'm smart. It's not because I persevered. They persevered. I mean, if I didn't persevere, it would be weird, you know, like given my chances. So I kind of feel like that's a shame. Don't do that. And I give my students a personal history assignment in the race class that I teach. And I ask them to trace back 4 generations and discuss like difficulties that generations had to overcome, and then like the identity stuff for today. Rarely can they do it. They're like, I don't know, I think they came from Ireland. I think it was difficult. I think my great-grandfather didn't speak English, I think. And I just feel like that's such a loss. You should know. Why don't you know your history? You know, how come we are like so disconnected within, you know, so they're 25 years old. Within 25 years old, they have no idea where their father have been. And that to me is sad. So I am all for giving money, volunteering, working towards it. But you know what? That personal connection and touching someone to see that there is a different way of doing things, and that it's worth the effort, and then it's not a burden, it's a privilege, it's a responsibility. I think that's a much more powerful message, in my opinion.
Can I add one thing
there?
Yeah. I was just thinking, if we looked in this country and went back 4 generations, would we still take for granted the access we have to education? You know what I mean? If we go back 100 or 150 years in this country, we didn't have universal access to education. Most people were still working in farms or working in factories in the early 1900s. So again, I think it's sometimes a little hard to feel connected to this. I mean, these stories are moving, but how does it affect us, or how are we connected to it? But I think it's an interesting thought experiment, and I would do it in education and think that it wasn't so long ago that people in this country didn't, you know, didn't have these opportunities either. So.
Or marry for love, yeah, or exactly. Marry when you're 27. You know, mm-hmm. Those things are rather new concepts. Mm-hmm. So children worked here too, mm-hmm. I mean, 100 years ago, mm-hmm. So.
Sheila. Well, I think my number one takeaway from the movie would be that, you know, the movie gives voice to girls, and it tells their story in a very simple way. And it shows that these girls have a reason to make some change in their life. And then they could sort of even group together and try to bring about change, as that girl in Nepal did. She got similar girls together, and they went and started singing in front of that house. And I think it gives inspiration to other girls in the world. If this movie is shown more widely, I think it would be a good way to figure out how women can band together and bring about changes, which is something that doesn't take place in a lot of the countries in Asia, especially the Muslim countries, in what is known as the stands, Pakistan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and those kind of places, where a lot of the women are kept behind closed doors in family compounds. They don't really even go out and mix around with the other families in the village, because they have so many chores to do. And so if we can bring this hope of change to the people there, I can see, you know, the literacy rate going up, education going up in places like this. And I know that this movie is being shown in a lot of other places. I think you said that, Brian. And I know that somebody's showing it in Pakistan, which was really surprising to me. I had no idea that people all over the world are hearing about this movie. So I think that this is a really great tool to do that.
You're listening to a panel discussion about the power of educating girls on Addressing Alaskans. It was recorded in the Alaska Public Media Television studio on December 5th, following a screening of the film Girl Rising. Panelists included Shayla Enjum, editor and writer in Anchorage, who you just heard from. She received a master's in public administration from the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, and most recently a master's of fine arts from the University of Alaska Anchorage. Before Shayla, you heard from Zainab Killick, assistant professor in UAA's sociology department, Brian Callahan, advocacy and outreach manager for the Global Campaign for Education, and Kimberly Pace, faculty director of the Model United Nations of Alaska and director of Women's Studies at UAA. In the second half of the program, the executive director of the Alaska World Affairs Council, Lisa Falsko, asked questions of the panel submitted by audience members.
Wow. I love this format. I don't know about you. I feel like I'm at a book club and everybody's sharing their own perspective. And it's just one simple question and so much information. So I keep on writing your questions. I will read them to our panelists. And please just jump in if you want to answer or add to the answer. This one obviously is for you, Brian. And it's a question: what is the connection between Global Campaign for Education and Global Partnership for Education?
That's a great question. So the Global Partnership for Education, which is not where I work, is an actual government-led funding agency for education projects internationally. It was founded, I think, in 2000, and it was originally founded within the World Bank as a way to sort of get countries and get donors to increase the amount of money that goes towards education internationally. Since then, it was originally called the Education for All Fast Track Initiative. It's been rebranded to the Global Partnership for Education. And it's really ramped up the work it does to try to fund education projects internationally on a government level. It's going into a period where it's trying to get more money actually from governments, including the U.S. government, and that I think they're trying to raise about $3 billion to go towards education in some of the countries that we're looking at here. They have, I think, 60 country partners around the world where they fund projects. So one thing that we're supporting, and that Results, Roger's over here from Results, that Results is supporting, is trying to make sure that the U.S. government makes a contribution to the Global Partnership for Education as part of this replenishment, so that, you know, that we can touch the lives not just of 9 girls, but of millions of girls around the world who still don't have this access to education.
Okay. How does one reconcile the fact that Pakistan and India have had strong women leaders, yet they're so far behind in girls' education?
Well,
who should answer that one? That's actually a broad question, I guess, for a lot of different countries.
I will tackle that because I am from Pakistan, but anybody else is, you know, welcome to jump in. I think one of the thing is, when you look at those leaders from India and Pakistan, both women, Indira Gandhi and Benazir Bhutto, came from extremely privileged backgrounds. They came from families that were Western educated, that were you know, aware of the power of critical thinking and how education helps you develop those powers. And Indira Gandhi, I don't know where she was educated because I'm not as familiar with her as I am with Benazir Bhutto, but I know that Benazir Bhutto went to Radcliffe College before it was part of Harvard, obviously. So she, and then she went to Oxford. So she was educated in the West. Her father was educated partly in California. The prime minister, Zulfiqar Ali Bhutto, who was the prime minister of Pakistan and was hung by the dictator, who was later replaced by Benazir Bhutto. So that makes a big difference. In my case, my family also was very, very well educated, so that probably made a big difference too. But I also know that not everybody comes from that kind of a privileged background. And there are ways to make changes. But the culture is so ingrained in places like Pakistan that men are the, you know, it's a patriarchal culture, so the men rule the family, and women don't have a lot of say in what goes on. So girls get the short shrift in education, like as it says in the movie at several points.
I would add to that as well that, you know, I think it's really an issue of social class. I mean, I've heard many of my fellow Turkish, you know, highly educated female friends here talk to, you know, American friends who ask a lot of questions about, oh, you know, you come from a Muslim country, you know, how is it like? And they'll give them this rosy picture, you know, oh, you know, we live in the cities, I wear bikinis, you know, it's all good, my husband doesn't mind that I work, all that kind of stuff, and people are really impressed. But, you know, it's only one part of the story. I mean, that is for the middle class, upper middle class, educated urban women. And the fact that they can do all those things, they can do them because we do them on the backs of poor women, right? Those are the ones who are taking care of our children, you know, cooking for us so that we can actually work and then come home and not have to fight with the husband because, you know, you don't have to do it all. And they're very cheap, right? I mean, we don't have to pay them too much. The fact that they're not educated and they don't have other options make it possible for, you know, women like me to sort of rise up a little easier. And those are the people who, you know, who become the elites and then who become sort of the spokespersons. But there's a huge class gap that needs to be addressed. I mean, you know, we had a female prime minister in Turkey as well, and she was educated at Yale, I think. She was actually an American citizen, went back. So, you know, you can be all proud of all those things. It's you know, it's a great accomplishment. But, you know, the other side of the story also need to be told, which is that in southeastern Turkey, girls are kept, you know, boys are sent to school, girls are kept because they need to carry water or it's not important to educate them. So both stories exist. And I think that obviously all stories that we've seen, they all had the poverty as a connecting sort of thread. And it's not like poor women in America have it so easy, you know? So the same issues, poverty and social class, they exist here too. So in that sense, I guess I would maybe would like to encourage people to think a little beyond, oh, in these faraway worlds with terrible patriarchal cultures, horrible things happen to women. You know, horrible things happen to women everywhere, including here. Obviously, we are wealthier, so therefore, some of this, you know, really kind of sad stories of seeing people, you know, living in the trash land, maybe, or the squatting situations might not be something that you see all the time. But it's, in that sense, it's a little bit relative. So I would, you know, I would like to move the idea that it's only far away places that have these issues. You know, similar things happen here too.
Well, yeah, I totally agree with you. I mean, we have huge education inequalities in the U.S. This is not just an issue that exists other places. And some of what I think we're getting at here exists in the U.S. as well. In Pakistan, I know that there's a big difference between urban and rural. So if you're living in an urban area, there's a better chance that you're going to have access to education. But the biggest inequality, as you were saying, really is that is economic, you know, inequality. And that really is what contributes to the education inequality. So, you know, if you're one of the very wealthy families in Pakistan, but also in a lot of these developing countries, and if you're a girl, you actually don't have a real struggle getting an education. That's like you were saying, that's where people like Benazir Bhutto come from. They come from...
Yeah, and the other problem in Pakistan is, of course, that the government does not put a lot of its budget into education. About 2.3% of the budget goes for education versus 10% for defense. Mm-hmm. And then the other problem happens is that you have all these schools that are not staffed. People are drawing salary because they are government workers, but they're called ghost schools and they're ghost teachers. In one province alone, there's supposed to be about 50,000 schools, I think, Balochistan, which is a very resource-rich province, but very poor, and about 10,000 or 6,000 or 7,000 schools are non-functional, and maybe about 5,000 teachers out of 29,000 teachers don't show up to work, and they just draw salaries.
I would also add, even in our state, in Alaska, what percentage of our high school students graduate from school in Alaska? 60%. Where the lowest in the country in terms of graduating high school students, which has profound implications not only on our state but in our communities, and goes beyond that, right? It goes nationwide as well. This is this idea about not having access to education or not completing education, it's not just in the developing world. It is very much alive and well right here in River City, right here.
If I may add one more thing, I wanted to thank Sheila for bringing up sort of the systemic issues, because like I'm thinking for my own history, healthcare was free, school was free. So even if my parents really wanted to educate me, if they had to pay for it, I wonder if they could, or would they choose to send my older brother to medical school and then stop there because I have to kind of realize that some things were possible because I got a free education, and not only that, the government actually gave me pocket money while in school so that you don't have to work and you live with your family, so those cultural sort of, you know, accepted ways of doing things make it actually possible. So, you know, clearly the institutional structures are really important, you know, what the state does and, you know, what is available. And then people just work within that system.
So. Okay, these are the exact issues that are coming up. Are you guys looking at these questions? So we'll follow up on some of this. Following up actually on what you're saying, both Shayla and Zeynep, so do you think that the government's role is to financially support education, and are governments sexist?
Yes.
Are governments sexist? And do they have a role in supporting higher education or financially supporting education?
Well, you're not just talking higher education, even starting at the primary level. I mean, you have to start right at the base before you can get onto higher education. And one of the big problems in a place like Pakistan and some other countries is that the religious schools are the ones who are giving free education, free room and board. Mm-hmm. So the poor people end up sending their kids to these schools where they learn rote memorization of the Quran, and they are well versed in what the prophet said or what he did not say, and they are, you know, there's certain things that are prescribed and certain things that are allowed. But on the other hand, these people are not taught how to think for themselves. They can recite the Quran, they may not even understand it because they don't read it with translation. They're just sitting there reading these Qurans, memorizing the verses, that's all they're doing. So yes, I do believe that the government has a duty to take care of education in countries where you do not have the resources. People are so poor that they have to provide it for them.
I was just going to add, I mean, from our perspective, we really talk about the fact that education is a human right. I mean, this is not just something we believe, this is something that the UN has recognized. Education is a human right. So I think if we recognize education as a human right, which a lot of countries' constitutions do, recognize it within the country as a human right. Ours, of course, doesn't recognize education as a human right. I don't know about Pakistan if it's in the constitution.
Probably not.
Probably not. Regardless, if it's a right, I do think that governments have a responsibility. And beyond the responsibility, as you're getting at, there's an interest in ensuring education, because in a place like Pakistan, because the government is not meeting that need, there are other groups that are stepping in and meeting that need, and it's not necessarily in the best interest of society for, you know, in some cases, religious extremists to be controlling the education. And, you know, I don't think you can really blame parents for sending their kids to these schools, because that's the only opportunity they have. So I think the governments have a responsibility to provide a different opportunity. And I do think sometimes we get caught up in, well, they can't afford it, or, well, there's not enough money. But, I mean, we talk about the statistic as well, that Pakistan is one of many countries that spends more, obviously, on defense than it does on education. We generally say that countries should spend up to 10% of their total budget on education through higher education. And so you mentioned Pakistan's is roughly 2.3%. Mm-hmm. So there might be some problem of Pakistan literally not having enough money to educate its people, but it's also a matter of priorities. The government's priority is on defense, and it's not necessarily on making sure that everyone has access to education, even though, as I said, you know, I think it's a human right, and they should be ensuring that human right.
I would agree with that. I mean, as an academic, yeah, I would say that any given patriarchal society is going to be sexist. That's kind of assumed, but it's also a lot of the time racism too. So for example, in the southeastern Turkey, you have almost like a feudal system that exists. But many of the people in that region are also Kurdish people. So who gets disadvantaged? Yes, it's girls, but it's also at the intersection of race, class, gender. So those things are usually very closely connected, and it's hard to kind of separate them. And also, we are all implicated in all those stories in a way, because most of them are also deeply affected by the liberalization policies of the IMF, the WTOs, the World Banks, and the corporate globalization that kind of rages around the world, that we don't seem to find any other way to do business. These are the displaced, dispossessed, marginalized people as a result of that system. And we are the ones buying, you know, their sweatshop labor, you know, $2 cheap thing at Walmart. So we are all implicated in it. So if you ask me, you know, in that sense, are we sexist, are we racist, you know, are we classist, are we ageist? Yes, we are, all of them. So.
And just because the Millennium Goals came out in 2000 from the United Nations doesn't mean that everybody subscribes to them. It's great. Education is a human right. Well, that makes sense, and I assume everybody in this room would agree. But governments are not everybody in this room, right? They're not always going to agree.
Okay, I'll do one more quick question, then Roger Hudson from Results is going to say a couple words, and that is, can someone elaborate on the health impact of educating girls?
Well, I guess I would flip that on the other side. What is the health impact of not educating girls? We saw statistics that in the film, dramatic reduction in AIDS, HIV, dramatic reduction in other illnesses as well. I think the question that I would ask is, what if we don't? What if we don't?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if whoever's asking this is getting at why is it connected? And I don't have enough expertise to necessarily answer that. I would just, you know, say, think about if the statistic that it was on in the movie is that 700,000 HIV cases could be prevented each year if all girls and women, I think, received an education. it seems like amazing that that one thing, you know, just educating could do that. The connection I see is it's sex education. It's knowing, it's women knowing how to protect themselves. That's why they're not going to get HIV if they have an education. And maternal and child health is obviously also tied to education, and it's the same thing. I mean, if a woman knows what she needs to be doing during a pregnancy to take care of herself and to take care of her baby, it's obviously a much greater chance that the baby and her are going to survive, you know, for the next 5 or 10 years than if she's had no education and she's had no health education and she doesn't understand what she needs to be doing.
You've been listening to a panel discussion about the power of educating girls on Addressing Alaskans. It was recorded following a screening of the film Girl Rising. Panelists included Brian Callahan, Advocacy and Outreach Manager for the Global Campaign for Education, who you just heard from, also Shayla Anjum, editor and writer in Anchorage, Zainab Killick, assistant professor in UAA's Sociology Department, and Kimberly Pace, Faculty Director of the Model United Nations of Alaska and Director of Women's Studies at UAA. In partnership with Alaska Public Media, the Alaska World Affairs Council hosted the screening of Girl Rising and the panel discussion in the Alaska Public Media Television Studio on December 5th, 2013. Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. The music is by Patrick Lee. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online anytime at alaskapublic.org. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Platt. Thanks for listening.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.